You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Donald, we've got, hopefully, we've got a man coming in as a guest to speak about, ex-coach of Carlton, and I played a lot of games for him, so we'll just wait till he turns up for a start, because I'm not sure how reliable he is, but I'm sure he'll turn up. But in the meantime, we were going to get, have a listen to this. So I say to Rocket Rod here, I said, now let's get Mark Robinson on again to speak about the football and the intricacies of the final and the grand final up in Queensland, about it costing, they had to pay $15 million bucks, and they say it's going to be a disaster, really, because the dew on the ground, all the clubs are training with greased up balls with slippery oil on them, so that they, I said, well, how ridiculous will that be? Did they not plan that out? Did they not think it was? So anyhow, so I say, let's ask Mark Robinson on again. So Mark Robinson says, oh, I want to be his friend now.
Hang on. Whose friend?
Listen to this.
He says, Mark Robinson said to Rocket Roddy, he said, Sam wants to be my friend now.
It wasn't like that.
Well, how was it?
What did you do to Mark Robinson?
Well, I'll tell you what I did to Mark Robinson.
Let's not do it again.
No, I'm not doing it again.
This is news to me.
Exactly. Thank you, Don.
I thought I was part of this podcast.
No, you are, but this wasn't worth being part of.
So Mark Robinson, who I get on very well with, I thought I did.
You do.
He potted me about something.
No, he didn't pot it. You potted him. He potted me.
Hippopotamy?
Yeah.
You potted me.
Oh, you potted me.
Hippopotamy.
I thought you said hippopotamy.
Potamy. You.
No. You got tongue-tied then. Admit you have.
He potted me some years ago, and then I reciprocated. You know, you have a go at me, I have a go at you. And we have spoken several times since. I even came on his very, very popular show he does called 360 on Fox. When Polly Farmer passed away, I came on to speak about the great farmer. And suddenly, Rocket Roddy tells me, he says,
I just thought you owed him maybe an explanation or something. All right, we love Robbo.
I love Robbo. Right. And if I need to say something bad about him, I will, but I'll do it to his face like he does to me. And this was, so he said, he wants to be my friend now.
This is bullshit,
Don. He wants to be my friend now. So this is an open invitation to Mark Robinson to come on.
Because we love him.
But shut up.
You've lost me, and I reckon you lost every bloody listener too.
And also, I had an interesting
chat. So, talking about personalities, I hear that you and Rocket, you call him Rocket, Rod, are coughing with Mike Sheehan. Now, is there a rumour that Sheehan's coming back on?
Well, hang on.
Tell me, you two, what's going on?
We're hopeful.
You're hopeful.
Look, Mick is missing us dreadfully.
Is there a pattern to his behaviour, Michael?
One of the funniest things I've ever seen, Don, was we happened to be with him when his horse was running.
Yeah.
And I wish we could play it, but we can't, because there was some language that was hilarious. But his horse ran last.
Oh, that thing by David Hay.
And Sam just gave it to him through the entire race.
So I'll tell you where.
And the poor bloke went to his
shell. We're round at Mick's joint. He said, there was only three of us there, and we were spaced. 3 metres apart. And Mick said, come round. I've got Zorro's ghost. And he said, it's running at Bendigo. So we all go around there. I've got the chips and the crisps, and we're having cups of tea and mix there. He's as nervous as a cat in a room full of rocking chairs. In fact, he was as nervous as a white mouse in a tampon factory. He's standing there.
What?
And he's
white
got the
mouse.
White mouse in a tampon factory. Think about that, Don. And so we're sitting on the couch just relaxed, and Mick's pacing. He's pacing his living room. He's twitching and I said, mate, sit down, relax, it's only a fucking horse. He said, no, I think it's up and running today because Dave Hayes has, the stable has said that it's up and about. So,
and he had everybody texting and calling him, asking him about whether they should put money on it.
Yeah, he said,
he's like, oh, mate, it's going well.
Only put 100 on it each way. He said, I wouldn't go in big. And his accountant rang and his friends and all his friends. So anyhow, they box the things up in the stalls and the red light flashes and bang, the gates fly open. And I know nothing about horse racing, nothing, absolutely nothing. After 40 metres, I said, it's going to come last. He said, and Rocket, Mick couldn't speak. He's actually choked with emotion just watching it. And Rocket said, why? And I said, well, it's throwing its head round. It's looking out at the crowd. It's not interested in the race. And so anyhow, Mick's got his eyes out.
He's standing up like he's a metre away from the screen. Right? He's standing in the middle of the room.
He got closer and closer to the television. We're sitting until he had his nose pressed up against the actual screen. And I said, come back, Mick. I said, come back and have a look at the horse run. And it got further and further behind. And to cut a long story short, some other horse greeted the judge, of course, and the bloke went right through all the horses. Got him, came in second, Gay Poss, Prince Banji, Pram Ram Marty, Scott, and last of all, Zorro's Choice, or whatever it's called.
Ghost.
And I said, Mick, it's come stone fucking motherless last. And he said, and this is the most statement I've ever heard, he said, it didn't run well. I said, it didn't run well. It didn't run at all, Mick. I said, let's put it in a panic and hope a death adder gets it in the summer and we'll get the insurance of it. Well, he asked us to leave. We had to leave his house.
He kicked us out.
He was as flat as a...
Because he wouldn't stop.
So he went into the fetal position again with his thumb in his mouth crying.
No, because Sam said, I'm here as your friend and I'm embarrassed.
Oh, I said, Mac, this is really embarrassing. I said,
get out.
Oh, well, he won't come back on.
Well, I think
if you left in that way, he would not come back on.
No, no. So then we left, and then he had another runner at like two. So that one was at midday, and he had another runner at about, I don't know, 2:45 or whatever. And Sam goes, "Do you want to go back?" And I said,
"We went."
So he was shattered. And we knocked on the door.
He said, "There's no one home." So in we went again, and it...
How's this one go?
As shit house. No, I don't know why he's spending his money doing that.
How's his vegetables?
He's better to come in here.
Yeah. His vegetables are good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You know those deformed capsicums and things?
Oh, shit.
Now, Don, we have a lot to speak about. We have
Hang on. So fill me in. This is our business meeting.
Yep.
So he may come back on.
Well, I'm.
Is there a pattern
that's
to his...
That's our word, not his.
Yeah, okay, but is there a pattern to his behaviour?
Yeah, he loves it.
No. Is there a pattern?
He loves it and he realises that the friends
Does he
who
ring you up on a Thursday afternoon?
Oh, he'll ring me this afternoon.
This is what I'm saying. So there's a pattern to his behaviour. So he rings Thursday, Tuesday afternoon.
He'll ring me and say, how'd it go? What'd you talk
right
about?
So what happens then?
Oh, then you just know he's missing it. He wants to
But what do you do? Get together for a coffee or anything?
Then I'll ring Sam.
The only drawback...
Ring me again, then we'll go around getting him for coffee. And so we're just working on him.
Oh, yeah. The only drawback...
What about his friends?
Jesus Christ, I'm going to...
Will you shut up?
He hasn't heard from them.
The only drawback is you, Don. The only reason he won't
listen,
come
I'm
on...
I'm quite prepared to give my seat up for... Now, listen, what about his friends?
That's not true, by the way.
What? His friends.
Nothing to do with you. He hasn't heard from them.
No.
He hasn't heard from them.
That's why.
But they were interested in his welfare.
He hasn't heard from all the people who advised him
his
to get
family?
Off the podcast.
Oh, yeah, they were there when Sam was bagging his horse.
Oh, so you're talking to the family.
His daughter
now.
And his grandkids had to listen to Sam bag his horse.
Oh.
So Mick is missing us greatly. Oh. He realises he's made an error, and I think he'll be back because he really enjoys... Don, you're the only problem. If you could get on with him a little better and actually
This is not true, Don.
Percy, Percy Jones has got a thing about him too, the fellow we're going to interview. I'd like to ask him about that.
Hang on, but can I just clarify? These are our words, not Mike's, okay? We're assuming all this. We think that he wants to come back.
I advertised his new coffee shop over in Bridge Road for his son. I did an ad, put it on my very, very popular Instagram platform. I can't do anything more for the family. I've driven him round. I've bought him meals. I think he'll come back. Don.
And I hope you're not lowering yourself.
What?
I hope you're not lowering yourself.
Too late.
I'm leaving the cat's head on the three of us. That cat's head will be removed. And
does he like the cat's head?
He doesn't like the cat's head.
He does.
And I said, we can't remove it because my son, Jack, who is technically
very
savvy with all this, he can't come into the studio because of the COVID restrictions. Right. And I can't get the cat's head. That's bullshit, of course. We can't get Can't get the cat's head removed, but we're going to remove it and put Mick back on top of the cat.
So you're going to have the cat's head and then Mick's head on top.
We might just have a little pussy body.
Speaking of Mick, what was the crap you guys were going on about with golf that you were banging on about earlier?
So you won't understand this, but this might be interesting to people who are sports fanatics or golf fanatics. The US Open was on just recently, which Bryson DeChambeau won.
Now, hang on, this bloke lifts weight. Hang on.
This bloke's gone. How hard is this going to be?
This bloke is a weightlifter or something.
Don, I tell you what you've got to do, mate. You've got to let me just get a sentence out that...
Go on. Okay, sorry.
No, Don. This man called Bryson DeChambeau, who bulked up and made himself strong, weightlifting and all that, so he could hit the ball a long way, and he thinks that he'll overpower all the golf courses by hitting the ball a long way. And he is a mathematician and a geometry student. He works out how to have the club, what angle, what the wind is. It takes forever and a day to play a shot, and it is infuriating if you're watching golf. It is so pedantic and so structured, it's become Formula One racing, in my opinion. It is just mind-blowing how long it takes to play a shot. So Mick Sheehan said, and this is Mick, and I'm giving him credit for this, he said, isn't it ridiculous that you can take so long to play a shot? How about we restrict the number of books and charts you can have that measure the slope of the green and how far it is to the green? Isn't it ridiculous that you can take so long over trying to read the green on a putting thing? There should be a time limit from when you get to your ball to play a shot so that the people watching, because that's what the game's about, don't get infuriated by games taking 6 hours to play. So we thought this would be a reasonable thing to push forward, and we would get a man on who is an expert and a great golfer, and we thought we might run these ideas past him and see what he thinks, and his name's Mark Allen, and we're going to try and get him on the phone. Now, it doesn't matter if you don't know anything about golf. The fact is that it takes so long to play a shot, and it is just infuriating for people watching, and it has got out of hand. So we're going to ring him now. This is Mark Allen. I hope he doesn't swear because he knows he's on air. So this is him here. We're trying to get him on. We did say we were going to ring him, but this is just waiting for the great Mark Allen to come on the phone. If you've rung the right number, Rocket.
Hello.
Mark?
Yes,
it's Sam. It is Sam Newman and Don Scott. We did preempt that we were going to try and ring you. And we've had a preliminary discussion about, Don doesn't quite know what this is about, not because it's not his fault, because he's not a golfer, but we watched Bryson DeChambeau take forever and a day to play every shot and every putt, although he is a great golfer, and we thought something has to be done in the name of spectator-friendly games that we can restrict how long it takes to work out how to play a shot or how to putt a ball into the hole. What do you think?
I don't know how you watched it. Once it became clear that he was going to win, my television went on. It is disgusting what the USGA and the RNA have let the professional game get to. The fact that you can draw a straight line on the golf ball and point it in the direction that you want the golf ball to go, and then you look down on your putter and there's a big line on the putter that matches up, you've taken one of the magnificent artful skills out of the game. Every single junior in the world is doing it. And consequently, junior rounds of tournament golf are now 4.5 to 5 hours, boys and girls, let alone what the pros are doing, playing in twos. I don't know what it was yesterday, but it seemed like 4.5 hours playing in twos, 5 hours probably getting up to playing in twos. It's ruined the sport, in my view. That's why so many people don't go to the golf anymore. Remember the crowds we used to get?
Yep.
amazing crowds, five deep.
Well,
at
Mark,
Huntingdale.
How refreshing that you say that, because it's easy to find fault with the various sports, but that is exactly right. So they put the line on the ball, a straight line, and they line it up with where they think the break of the putt or the green goes, and then they get back and then they think, oh, well, I haven't quite got that right. So they remark the ball and they reposition the line. It goes backwards and forwards. So here's...
Hang on. The ball is round. I'm a novice at this, but it's just it's a round ball, so it wouldn't really matter where that line is. It's not going to go... circle over circle or line over line.
Yes, it is.
It does.
What's that, Don?
Don't show it.
So they line the line on the ball is it not necessarily pointing at the hole, is where they want to aim the putt.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, well, we'll putt. That's where. And then they get down, they think, oh, no, I've got the line out a bit far. I'll just bring it. And it doesn't matter if you don't understand that. But
so
it is.
Are you saying they're allowed to move, to constantly pick the ball up and move
as
it?
As long as they remark it. So what they do is, and so here's the simple solution to that, Mark, surely. Once you get to your ball and mark it, what about we have a time limit of 45 seconds on the clock that it takes you? You're allowed 45 seconds to mark the ball, clean it, and putt. That would
be... We do. That rule is there. But the people the sport, that rule is there. The people governing the sport don't enforce it. Unless you're a 14-year-old Chinese kid who played in the Masters. That's the only time I can remember somebody getting a two-shot penalty, because they are so gutless, Sam, absolutely mind-blowingly gutless, to actually enforce the rules that are there. If you ask, or if you polled all the players, 90% of them would say, listen, enforce these rules and penalise the players. That's just with putting. I don't know whether you've been watching how often they go back to their little book, their little green reading book. Have you seen this as well?
Absolutely. So this was Mick Sheehan and I were having this discussion. What about they ban the books? What about if you want to see, if the caddy wants to see how the course is playing, he comes out in a practice man around, or he walks around the day before, and they have no books. And why wouldn't they be allowed to use the GPS machines, because you arrive at the same result? Yeah. Just hold the GPS machine up to see how far it is and say, that's it. That's how far. It's 165 yards, play a shot.
Hang on, explain the book.
The book, they have charts about which way the green slopes.
Well, no, hang on. The book's published on what every green in the world or that's played in a tournament?
I think there's a company set up to actually print the books out, isn't there?
Yeah. They get it off the satellite. It's incredibly accurate. Like, it's accurate within a couple of millimetres. They do it from satellites, and it is a perfectly sloped look at exactly what the green is doing. And you know what has taken it out of the game? Once upon a time, if you had a downhill quick six-footer and you didn't have the book, but the putt looked straight, but you had this feeling inside that maybe it was right to left, well, more often than not, in those situations, when you didn't have a book, you'd go, okay, well, I've got to take a chance here. I've got to risk missing this putt to actually hole it. And you would just bang it straight in the middle, a little bit firmer. These days with the book, if you've got that same curling putt, percentages say, you look at it, you go, okay, well, the green reading book tells me it might go a little bit to the left here. So what they do, instead of actually taking it a risk and hitting it firmer, they hit it softer on that six-footer down the hill. And more often than not, the book is correct, and they don't challenge themselves with the risk-reward that's always been one of the great parts of golf. That is now missing on the green.
So I didn't realise, Mark, that they actually have a time limit to make a putt, do they?
Yes. Look, in the old days, it used to be 40 seconds for the first player, and 50 seconds for the first player and 45 or 40 seconds for the second and third player. But they don't enforce it. They don't even come close to enforcing it. The only time they have is at the Shot Clock Masters on the European Tour, and guess what happened? Record rounds, all of them under 4 hours. It's just mind-blowing.
So, Mark, I thought it was the caddy's job to get there a couple of days beforehand and go and map the course out. What you're saying now is that the caddy no longer has to do that, or he downloads something on the computer and he transcribes that onto his pad. Is that what you're saying? Yeah. And then he takes that around.
Yeah, that's right. Well, look, you get a Yardies book at the start of every week. It costs you $50, the good ones. And that's been happening for, you know, since Jack Nicklaus was a kid. He started the whole Yardies thing himself. He used to pace it off himself, and he got the advantage, and he ended up winning 18 majors with that advantage. The next guy who used to do the books on the green was Bernard Langer. Don't get me started with the Bernard Langer putting situation.
We'll get onto that in a minute.
That's another farce. But these days, a smart character has decided to use the satellites to map out the greens on the contours with supreme accuracy. And like I said before, it takes risk and reward away from the game and puts about, I don't know, 30 to 35 minutes on the game.
Yep.
So rounds that would normally be a four-hour round are now 4 hours 30, 4 hours 35. And it is mind-numbing to watch it on the TV.
So what you're saying, I don't know this. So as they're coming down the fairway, he's got his book, and it's just with regard to a distance. That's the only thing, the fairway. But you get to the green, he's then got a number of different sheets or pages depending on where this ball is. So he can so wherever he is on the green, he can refer to that particular page.
Correct. Wait.
God.
Yeah. Yep. And he knows the break. He knows. So he doesn't know the grain that you can see, but he knows which way gravity will push the ball.
And all this it's like the Grand Prix. They've completely devalued the franchise of the Grand Prix because the cars are so. And this is infuriating for people that watch. And in the end, all sport is reliant on the fans and the fan base and the sponsors. Yep. And unless you tape the golf, that is, tape it and just trawl through all this other nonsense and just watch the actual shots you want to play. So Mark, it would be sensible to have no caddy books, no line on the ball, time limit for each shot, either on the green or on the fairway, and no added aids, except why wouldn't you be able to use a GPS machine just to say, right, it's 160 yards, have a shot. Instead of players actually pacing it up 160 yards and coming back. But, of course, the time limit restraint would stop them doing that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, it would. If you've got a good caddy, by the way, it takes exactly the same time because the caddy moves forward, he gets it all done. And the thing that the GPS won't tell you is where the slopes are on the green. Yep. And when you've got a wedge in your hand, you want to know to land it on top of a tier and all that kind of stuff. Yep. So, look, the GPS is a good one for players who are doing their own yardages. That'd be a big help. If all the things you just said, the USGA and the RNA, they just clicked their fingers and made that happen next time around, 5 hour rounds on both tours, the European and the US tour, would go to 4 hours.
So
simple.
Before we just say why don't they do that, now you and I hate to say this, since Adam Scott won the Masters with a long putter, which was legal, so let's not cut him we'll cut him a bit of slack, but they then brought out a rule that you cannot use the long putter, you cannot anchor it. There's players still using it, and it is just pure nonsense to say that club or the top of the butt of the putter doesn't touch the chest. It can touch the apparel. That is, why would you use it if you're not using it illegally? Bernard Langer, and there's a few on the main tour that use it. Why don't they just say you cannot use a long putter? It cannot be any longer than the longest club or whatever. Some reason. Why can't they do that and bite the bullet with all these rules?
They should have. It's because they are gutless. That's why. And
why?
What is happening on tour right now, the two blokes on the seniors tour, McCarron and Langer, they've been 1-2 on the order of merit, I reckon, the last 5 or 6 years in a row. And behind the scenes, the players are absolutely filthy because under pressure, when they need it the most, it's amazing how often that the end of the club becomes the anchor.
Yes.
And people who aren't okay with the game, the reason we don't like it is because one great big long shaft cannot break down. There are no hinges. When you putt normally, you've got elbows, you've got shoulders, you've got hands and fingers.
Yeah, it's like a
pendulum.
All
those little bits and pieces, that's right. All those little things can break down, but by definition, A pole has no hinge. It cannot break down. And if you keep the anchored point still, then you have a beautiful pendulum and all the skills gone out of the game. A lot of players are just basically putting their bicep against their chest, and that's the new anchor point. And
so
what
Mark,
they do, yes?
So, Mark, these are simple things to enact. You say they're as weak as piss. Is that, well, why are they? It's not a sponsorship thing. It's not nothing to do with it would do with the crowds. It's nothing to do with losing. It's just, why don't they just implement those things? No yardage books, no line on the ball, no green reading devices, and time limits between when you get to your ball to play a shot or when you get to the green to have a putt. Why couldn't you, and no long putter, why couldn't they simply bite the bullet and in 2021, when the coronavirus is over, we'll start afresh?
Well, the simple answer to your question is because they're too stupid.
Why?
That's why. They are stupid people, and I think that they are concerned about the kickback from players and players' unions, but they are the people in charge of the rules. Now, I've got, like, my view on this, if an anchored putter, and you're a local player, you just play casually, and you can't putt anymore, then your handicap will take care of it. You know, if you shoot 85 with a short putter, but then you shoot 80 with a long putter, then your handicap will come down from 15 to 10. It's all taken care of. It's no worries. If it keeps you playing, go and play. Your handicap will be adjusted. But at the highest level, it is fair and cheating. And I think they are just concerned that they're going to see people like Bernard Langer, you know, leave the tour early. I don't understand it myself. I've hated long putters for a long, long time, Sam. When I was playing, and I'll be self-indulgent here just for a second, in the 93 Australian Masters, I came fifth. Three blokes ahead of me had long putters. Now, the difference in second prize to fifth prize was about $120,000.
Yep.
And I felt like that then they were cheating. So what these players on the seniors tour who play for much, 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 much more money than I do, when they see the two guys who are leading and continuing winning on that champions tour, I would feel like they are stealing out of my pocket.
Mark, can I ask a question? Why aren't all clubs standardised? Now, I see many shapes of putters, heads, different thing, whatever.
Yeah.
Same with your, you know, you've got different types of shafts. Why doesn't everybody or one person manufacture the club? You all play with the same club or clubs.
Look, in theory they could, but
that's not the problem.
You're
away from the game.
Yeah, but you're being pernickety over things. I look at clubs and I say, "Well, hang on, he's got a different shape."
It's like
club
motor cars, Don.
No. I think you could take this a lot further to make the game fairer. You blokes are talking about fairness. I think you could standardise the club so everybody plays with the same club.
No, but there's manufacturing.
I think they do that to the best of their ability. To tell you the truth, that's not a concern for me. I can see from an outside looking in to the game of golf where that might make sense, but. I think it's one of the great things, you know, you're not putting so well, you go in the pro shop, you pick up something else, and away you go, you have 38 points the next day, and you think you're a hero again. So I quite like that part of it.
And they cut the square grooves out of the pitching wedges, didn't they?
Yeah, but now they've got, you know, now the technology, they've got sharper grooves these days, Sam, so you get as much spin. That's what's happened. I'm not sure. Walk into the TaylorMade factory, when you walk into the TaylorMade factory, their slogan at the top is, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to work here, but it helps.
Yep.
That's what you've got. You've got people like that working for golf, and I think it's hurting the game.
Well, Mark, people like you, and not shit kickers like me and us, but honestly, there's got to be a push to do something. If you've got these people in charge and they're just there for the ego instead of actually making something happen for the benefit of the people who watch, it is infuriating. Yeah. Now, you should get onto your friends and have a push to have this changed. Now, before we let you go, we nearly weren't speaking to you 18 months ago because you nearly weren't here. How is your health and what is the prognosis of life going forward, please?
I'm happy to say that I'm 100%. You know, I've got to go back and get checks all the time, but, you know, I've just come back from an 8-kilometre walk and I'm breathing pretty well. And, you know, the only trade-off has been really is that I don't breathe as well when I run these days, and I don't run too often, and I've got to go to the loo probably 4 or 5 times a day. But the trade-off with feeling healthy has been fantastic. So I'm in good shape. Thanks for asking.
Well, good on you, mate. And prediction about Bryson DeChambeau is if he can continue that for the next 3 years without doing his back, I'll be staggered. He says he's going to put on 20 pounds for the Masters. He says he's going to keep getting stronger and bigger and hit the ball harder and harder. If his back lasts any more than 2 years, I'll be staggered.
I'm with you there. That'd be more of a freak thing to happen, that he gets through injury-free than if he won the Masters playing like that as well. Thanks, boys. Thanks,
Mark Allen, thank you so much. And push that along, please, for us.
I'll get it done.
Thanks, Marco.
Now, Don.
I can't. Listen, I thought I brought up a point.
You did.
Blokes are being pernickety about certain things. Why wouldn't you play with everybody plays with a standardised club? Now, you can drive, I understand. You know, they had hickory sticks back or whatever they did back
hickory
in the early
sticks,
days.
Hickory shafts.
Shafts. Mm-hmm. Now these shafts or clubs with the big heads, can drive the ball much further than what the predecessors used to be able to do. Why wouldn't you go back to what the game or how the game was designed?
Because there's a number of manufacturers like the car industry.
Yes, but you bring in a rule, Johnny.
You cannot. A number of manufacturers survive in this free enterprise world that we live in about manufacturing clubs that people want to buy as opposed to the opposition. I understand what you're saying. You can limit the size of the heads on clubs. You can limit the size of plenty of things. But you cannot stop having all the clubs standardised as long as they fit in the parameters of what a golf club should be. Make those rules and then let people manufacture clubs. I understand that. But
it's the same with tennis. If you do a comparison, now back in the 50s they were playing with round wooden rackets, smaller heads. Yes. Now you can hit the sweet spots just about anywhere this great big racket. So how can you compare the skills of players of today as against yesterday? I think the players of yesteryear with the smaller headed rackets generating the power and serve and volley were much more skillful than what these people are.
Okay, so make the standard head of a racket the standard size and then let the manufacturers make them with different frames and different gut and different strings and different handles. That's fair enough. You make a good point. But the points that we were mentioning is it has become such a mathematical formula in a sport that takes excruciatingly long to play and watch that it is devaluing the sport, in my opinion, and in Mark's. Now, Donald. What have we noticed about the game? The finals are upcoming, and if Mark Robinson, who still wants to be our friend, can come in and speak about it, they say it's extremely unlikely that the game will be of any great standard, given the dew that is on the ground in the Gabba come the finals time.
Who's they?
This is the people who are the meteorologists who say, why would the clubs be training with slippery balls, if you'll pardon the expression, slippery balls that they put oil on to try and handle the thing properly because they're anticipating the conditions that might prevail on grand final night, Donald?
Well, that's something that's come question without notice because I didn't know that was the problem in Queensland. Dew at night, is there?
So they say.
Mick reckons that they put the balls in soapy water to train.
Well, we did all that, Mick Sheehan.
Yeah. Oh, Mick Sheehan, the man who's
you were there.
Yeah, I know. I was just.
Well, we did that when we. I don't know about you. We certainly did it when we were playing. But we were going to play on a wet day, so we'd put the balls in the bucket and we'd handle those before we actually went out.
But he reckons they're oiling them and putting soapy water.
We used to do all of that type of thing to handle a ball or get used to it before we ran.
Yes,
out
because
on an adverse day.
Yes, because Donald, you'd get a few adverse days, but you just put up with the weather conditions. Every night, they say, the dew comes in and you'll never have a dry day or a dry night because the dew at that time of the year is ever present.
Well, that's something I didn't. Yeah, okay.
Yes. I notice here's one of the remarkable things. This is sort of sport, but this is politics. I notice the Sharon people who make the balls have been given a dispensation to go to work because they got to make balls for the finals. And that'll make people happy, wouldn't it?
I think there'd be a lot of football manufacturers or importers would have a lot of stock on hand at the moment because a lot of leagues are just not playing football.
And what about the...
Why do they need to make... There should be plenty of footies lying around, shouldn't there?
Yeah, now they've been given dispensation to go to work, like all of Victoria haven't been given dispensation to do anything.
The top competition balls are still made here. Maybe this is the reason. I've been out, when Tommy was actually alive and in Collingwood.
Tommy Sharon,
when he was actually alive back in the 70s. Young Tommy took it over. I think they might have sold it to Dunlop.
How come when Hawthorn played, they used to play with a Ross Faulkner?
Well, that was my choice because what Ross Faulkner used to do was slip $50 into your hand, and Ross Faulkner was a different shape to the Sharons. Yep. And I do remember Lee Matthews coming, "What the hell are you picking a Ross Faulkner for?" Well, the captain had the choice. And Lee, I'll tell you now, Lee, I got $50 for every Ross Faulkner ball I picked for a final.
That's so dodgy.
Well, that's what went on.
What about Lyrebird? They didn't put the money up.
Nutting and Young. They weren't
Nutting
around.
Nutting and Young, yeah.
They weren't around. They were in Glen Iris, I think, weren't they? They used to manufacture their balls in Glen Iris.
So quite a number of players have been fined for breaking the COVID rules by sneaking out of the hub. This is, we said this the other day, if you're going to go up to a competition and not abide by its rules by earning $400,000 a year to play football and lolling about on the beach, it is extraordinary that the clubs wouldn't be more stringent and more pointed with their players to say, just demand that there's not even a suggestion or a thought of doing anything outside the guidelines. It is staggering that they can't control their own players.
I don't know what runs through these players' heads. Okay, the first one, okay, he's got away with it, but you'd certainly, if you brought down a harsh penalty, but for numbers of players to go against this is their opportunity in life to maybe better themselves. You only get one opportunity in life, and maybe for a lot of these young fellows, football's their opportunity. Certainly was in my case, and you've got to make the most of it. Why blow it?
So, Don, we say this often. Never blame the people that work for you or play for you. Blame the people who employ you. This is absolutely the 100% responsibility of the people who run those clubs. They're up there lolling about. This is the administrators and the people and the presidents and the people who run the clubs. They're up there. If they couldn't impress on their charges, their staff, their players, that this is not on, they honestly should resign en masse. It is extraordinary. And I see Eddie Maguire taken to task for going to a nightclub with his son. And they said, oh, well, if it's good enough for the players not to do it, why is it good enough for Eddie? Eddie is not in the hub. They tried to single him out, saying that he was hypocritical. And this is just the dishonesty of people trying to make a headline out of something. He did nothing illegal. He did nothing wrong. He did nothing that was outside the guidelines. He's not in the hub as such. So he can go and do whatever he likes. And they all jump up and down because they thought, oh, this is good press and he's fair game. And it wasn't. And they said, oh, there shouldn't be one set of rules for him and one set for everyone else. Well, there is one set of rules for people like Eddie because he's not in the hub. And no one else has to abide by those rules. So just dishonesty again, rearing its ugly head, Donald.
Now, because I do this podcast, I've got to watch football or try to. And as a watcher, I expect, you know, the players to commit themselves to the game in hand. I couldn't believe it last week when Heath Shaw gives an interview at quarter time. Now, you know, the way that he conducted, which was very good. But what went through my head, this man's not fair dinkum. If you're in a game of football where it's very serious, you could not recompose yourself and give an interview at quarter time. Well,
your
job.
It's very old fashioned, Donald.
What?
It's very old
fashioned. Well, I'm just saying, and I go back to a grand final, which is all a leveller, and everybody is tuned in on the same wavelength. They approach the game differently through the season, but come grand final day, there's an eerie silence in that room. Everybody is tuned in to exactly the job in hand. We're all the same. We can go on with the bullshit and all the rest of it. But if they were feeding, and also I'll go on with the Melbourne players. I saw a little snip of those guys at a three-quarter time huddle, supposed to be listening to the coach, and they're mucking around, tickling one another. I mean, how feeding them are they? Well, tickling or pinching or
groping.
Tickling. Well, you can say groping. They're just not. These guys are not serious in the way they approach their sport. They're just not serious, and I think that's an insult to the people, the members who are out there barracking for their teams.
Yeah, they were playing for a final spot too. I agree with that. The Melbourne boys.
Oh, Melbourne, Melbourne.
That was I agree with that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm biased because of what I used to do for a job. What? With broadcasting footy. But I don't know that it's not
speaking. Christ.
No, don't He's blaspheme.
Speaking of footwear. Sorry, Donald.
Go on, Rocket. Oh, yeah, you've been quiet for weeks, but now you've got your voice again.
Speaking of the microphone.
No, I'm just saying. I think Heath Shaw knows. He can do it. A few words to somebody at quarter time. Then when he's got his head under the ball, he knows that he's got to do the right thing. I don't know that he goes.
Sorry, Rod. It's television. When I was broadcasting, Gordon Bennett. Said to
my old boss,
"You righto." Gordon said, "We are going to have, or we're going to put commercials in each centre bounce down after a goal of score. We're going to have." I said, "Gordon, you couldn't do that." He said, "They're doing it in America now. You watch."
Oh, did that happen during your time?
My time, and they had a light, up in the commentary thing. It went on, and as soon as that light went off, they bounced the ball. The umpires were looking at the light above our broadcast area for the commercial to finish, then they'd bounce the ball. So I thought, that is the start of the ruination of football.
Yes, so that's why you don't watch Channel 7, you watch Fox, because they don't do that.
No, I'm just giving you the reason why or the root of it. And now they've gone, the television, they've got to pay a lot more money for the rights, but they say, okay, we want access to the coach before or after the game. So we want access to the rooms before and after. We want to interview players. You're asking for more money. Okay, we'll justify why. Will you give us a bit more? And so it is the AFL that is a problem because of the way they're increasing the fees, but it's also the channels, the networks asking for more for their dollar. So now they've watered the game down to what it is. It's not even fair dinkum. They're not fair dinkum.
Who aren't? The players.
The players.
Yes, they are. I
watch their body language in a lot of cases. I see some blokes not even trying and chasing. For professional athletes, the handball. Now, these guys are professional.
That's separate to than Heath Shaw giving a quarter time interview.
No, the whole thing is their approach.
I'm with you about being addressed and them messing around and groping each other while the coach is speaking to them. That gets back to if the club is not run properly, if the hierarchy don't demand that they don't do that, just let them get away with it, it'll go on. So I'm with you there. But don't tell me a bloke called Heath Shaw or anyone couldn't, as he's walking off the ground, be asked by, in the name of having one of the combatants actually speak to the public, couldn't say, just as he's walking off, make a comment about the game. That wouldn't sap too much of his concentration, would it, or integrity?
Well, we all have different approaches to our different walks of life, and I cannot relate to that at all.
Can you relate to this? Don Bradman, they reckon, used to play and practice cricket as a youngster, a 12-year-old, on the concrete pitch at Barrel. The concrete pitch is now overrun with weeds and the oval is never used, but they won't upend it or ruin it because it's now got national heritage because Don used to practice on it, and they're holding back a multi-million-dollar retirement village because they won't dig up the cricket pitch. What do you think about that,
Don? Don't they have a Don Bradman Museum at Barrel as well at the ground?
Yes.
No, I think I would leave the ground.
You'd leave the cricket pitch?
Yes, and I would maintain it.
Fucking ease up. What?
We have,
it's all overgrown.
What history have we got in Australia? Very little history. We've got natural history. Well, go to Europe, you see man-made history dating back thousands of years. Yeah. Certainly we've got it with the Aboriginal Indigenous people, their history, you know, in this world, dating back thousands of years. But as far as Caucasians coming to this country, there's not much.
Well, I tell you what, if you're going
to
leave...
we've got to create or respect our...
You're going to leave the concrete cricket-pitched barrel.
Yes,
how in God's name could you leave the grandstand at Waverley Park as a national monument?
Well, I think there was a lot of politics going on then because Hawthorn took it over and the AFL wanted to sell that ground.
That's right.
And the state government were saying, no, you can't
do it. How was that a national monument?
Well, they were going to get $80 million. I think they got $80 to $100 million for the ground back then. I think they sold it to Mervac.
But the stand, it's the remnants of the stand is there. It's just a stand. It was built in 1970.
It's been repurposed.
Well, what? Hawthorne are out there.
As a building, it's been repurposed.
But it has been classified. The whole thing's been classified.
The National Heritage, yes, 70 years has. Old it is.
Yes.
1970 yes. It was built.
There's a lot of politics going on
stage. Politics.
That's right.
Yeah. So
politics in other spheres now too. Listen, just
so where was Don Bradman born?
Adelaide, wasn't he?
No, hang on. He moved to Adelaide. No, I think he was a country boy, New South Wales country. Cessnock or something?
No, not Cessnock, but people think he was born in Barrow.
No. He was a country boy.
Mm, he was.
Just going back to the AFL. Beg your pardon?
Are you going to tell us?
Yeah, I can't remember.
Cootamundra.
That's it, Cootamundra.
Yeah, Cootamundra, that's it. Magic Door got listed last
week. Yes.
Now, certain players, we just touched on it when you were at Geelong as a ruckman with Hampshire not getting a go, but he goes to Geelong, gets exposure.
Footscray.
If you were at Footscray, if you were over at Richmond when Kevin Bartlett was there in the 70s, you would not have even got a show because Bartlett stayed on the ground as a rover all day. So you'd never get exposure as a rover, so you'd never blossom. Now, Magic Door, because Goldstein's been there, I thought he was a real chance as a ruckman because of his athleticism and his ability to jump at the centre.
Natanui-esque.
Well, he was. He was as good as when Natanui started, but because he hasn't got the exposure, they tried to turn him into something else. Radigalia at Geelong, who's wearing your number 17, he came onto the scene a couple of years ago and had great potential. They played him in the ruck on Saturday of last week. And again, he showed something. But he's really at the crossroads. And one player playing for Collingwood now that's being crucified, and they should look at it, is Cox. Now, they could change Cox and Grundy in the ruck, put Grundy down there, would it change the dynamic change the dynamic of the team, let Cox run around on the ball. The height that Cox is, he would be... a very good ruckman and would add another dynamic to the team, but he is going to be crucified.
So we've got Peter Jones coming in. He's 6'6". How big is Cox?
Oh, I don't know.
How big's the normal Cox?
Stop it.
I don't know. What's the average height of the Cox family?
7 foot? No. I think he's 7 foot. I think he's an exception in his family.
Yeah, 2.11 metres, which is what?
That's 6'6". That's 6'10", 9'10".
No, he'd be bigger than – he'd be taller.
2.1 metres, 6'11", 6'6", 6'10".
Anyway, I think he'd be
a real force.
Yeah, well, 6'11". He'd be a real force on the ball, and he's been crucified. And there are two fellows. And Dorr could be I don't know whether I'd pick him up as with a draft choice, but I'd certainly pick him up as a rookie and play him in the ruck – in a VFL team, in an AFL team, and just see how he develops as a ruckman.
Well done. So I tell you who I was speaking to during the week, a bloke called Peter Crackers Keenan.
Oh, yeah.
I was having a chat to him about a...
I didn't think you two were talking.
I was having
Nor did he when he got the call.
I was having a chat to him about a very interesting game he went and watched at Victoria Park between St Kilda and Collingwood 20 years ago. And I was having a chat to him about that game. And I said to him, by the way, I said, you might come in and have a chat to us on the podcast. He says, Don Scott doesn't like me. And I said, Don doesn't like anyone. I said, but I then suddenly remembered that he punched you out at Waverley, didn't he? And then he went down with a crook back. And you So would, if he came on, my point of me bringing this up, Don, look at him. The point of me bringing this up is, so could we get Crackers on the podcast?
I'm just the third rung in this thing. You'll do whatever you want to do.
No. Don.
I make suggestions as who's to interview.
Who's your last suggestion?
Father Bob Maguire.
Well, have you rung him up?
Oh, so you just handball. You're very good at deflecting, aren't you?
You've mentioned Bob Maguire.
You're as good as this, what's his name, Andrews. Daniel Andrews. When it comes to a question where you're confronted, you're as good as Andrews at deflection.
Let's go through the last 10 people that have been guests.
I've given up. No. Once you get just hit a minute. Down once, you
let's,
learn to keep
let's
your head down.
Let's go through the last 10 people who have been guests on this podcast. How many have you secured?
Johnny,
none.
I gave up 6 months ago making suggestions.
Well, you've suggested Bob Maguire. I reckon this is the seventh time. Have you rung him?
Well, when I mention it, you say...
What do I say?
Oh, what do we talk to him about?
Don, I don't say that. You said we'd like to get him on to ask him, is he still... Did he get sacked, I think, didn't you say, from the church? Didn't you say that? I said, yes, that's a good question. Then what'll we ask him? And you said... Well, I don't know. If you don't want to get him on, then don't ask him. I said, well, you ask him. Bring him on. I said, well, get Mick Hone on. And you said, who's Mick Hone? And I said, he's a Suzuki dealer and...
Superbike rider.
Yeah, and you said, well, I don't know what to ask him. Well, you asked. You went for 20 minutes without drawing breath. You asked, and very interesting it was too, Don. I'm only just... So if I got asked Crackers to come on, could we speak to him about... Why he punched you that day out at Waverley? Why did he punch you?
I'm thinking Waverley. How would I know why he punched me? How would I?
Oh, because you
like
probably
to
said
know the confrontation you and he were going to have at Channel 9 one night.
Channel 9.
They had it.
They did.
They end up having it in the ring.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that's right.
You put the gloves on.
Yeah, I did.
He got beaten. He got the shit beaten out of him.
Yeah, but I knew that. I laid down my sword because he said something about me and I said something about him and he took exception to it. And he rang me up. I'm happy to say this. He rang me up and I said...
I thought he was consulting a solicitor too.
He did. And he said, I said, oh, come on. I said, you had a go at me. I had a go at you. I said, I tell you what, come down. We went down to Jack Rennie's gym down in Essendon. And I remember sitting there putting the gloves on. I said, go on, I'll go one round with you and you can get the press there and see if you can beat me, knowing that he could because he's a good fighter, Crackers, boxer. And so the bloke's putting the gloves on me, lacing him up, and he said, I'll tell you what I do. He said, just keep your jab. I said, mate, you're trying to tell me how to box while you're lacing the gloves up, are you? I said, fair dinkum. So they rang the bell. Well, he went rat-a-tat-tat. I spent that summer in a wheelchair. So I've recovered and here I am and he's a good man and we could get him on and we could say why he punched the living shit out of me and why he belted you at Waverley one day. And he's got some good stories about everything, Ron Andrews and all that.
And what about, talking about football, can we go on with another one called Gary Ablett? You didn't happen to see on YouTube his...
Fantastic. Wasn't it great?
Well, I thought he was, I'm not... agreeing or disagreeing with what he actually said, but he certainly seemed to me to know his topic and he was well versed. He was well versed in his topic and he didn't draw breath. He spoke with a surety
very articulate
and confident. I thought he was very good, but I don't know what he was talking about, but he certainly knew
his
subject.
So good you didn't know what he was talking
about. Well, no, you can put a story across in a very convincing way and I thought
but you still can't tell us what he was talking about.
Well, I do understand about the coming. He's born-again Christian and all the rest of it and so forth, and he puts certain arguments forward. And you always take it away and you think, well, that's
interesting. What about the way, though, after one rant, the paper was saying...
Now, yeah. it wasn't, to me, a rant. Is
hang on.
An emotional
context. Let me finish.
Outburst.
Let me finish. And the people were worried about his health and his state of mind. It was the headlines, okay? My thing is this. Sam does it every second day, and nobody worries about him.
So well, he's far more measured than what this fellow is when he's off camera, off air.
Not always.
So
he's sane when he's on with the microphone in front of him.
So Gary Ablett would be fit into that category where fluency is not necessarily a substitute for substance. So just because I liked Gary Ablett because he believed in the world is nigh and the Saviour, Jesus Christ, if we don't embrace him, he is our only hope. Whether you think he's mad or not, I thought, fantastic, good on him for doing that. He's saying what he believes. He's happy to wear his heart on his sleeve.
No argument from me.
And I actually tweeted, I said, isn't it great? How much wisdom can someone possibly have? And he's good on him. And
turn it up. What do you mean, turn it up?
Jeez, let it go. Let's go. Let's move on.
No. did you watch Tour de France?
Not even if I thought it'd solve world hunger.
I understand it can be boring.
Boring.
Well, the hill columns are not bad when they're making position. It's a great tourist show for France. It really puts them on the map, and it's the commentary, I think, about different points of interest are good. But there was one lady, and she was an inclusion this year, Bridie O'Donnell.
Lady? Riding in the Tour de France?
No, she was commentating,
good, yeah, right.
And I thought she is very, very good. She's a cyclist herself. She grew up in Queensland. I think she was also a triathlete who then went to cycling, and she set a world record, 46-odd Ks in 1 hour at the Velodrome in Adelaide.
Tailwind?
How fast is that?
46 Ks an hour for an hour. Oh, you...
46 k's an hour is...
No, she did 46 k's in 1 hour.
I know that.
She set the world record.
I was trying to think of how many miles an hour that is.
Miles an hour, yeah. Or k's an hour.
No, miles. I was trying to just translate that into miles an hour, because 100 kilometres an hour is 60 it's miles an hour.
27 so miles per hour or something like that. Good.
Around in the velodrome.
Yeah.
The board track, as they used to call it. Well, is that it, Donald?
What about?
Sport. We're going to come back.
Well, I just wanted
28 and a half miles.
Yeah, I said 27.
The Go other on. Thing that I thought after watching last night's game, I thought Ken Hinckley was under a bit of pressure to retain his job at Port Adelaide. Lo and behold, they finish on top. He's the king once again. So he's got an extension to his contract.
And no one's
They're him. Interesting, aren't they?
And no one's tipping him for the granny.
And what about your man at Hawthorn? Has he dodged a bullet? Alistair Clarkson.
Well, you can't do it on one. They will be a basket case for 5 years.
Oh,
well, they've got to go.
So there's the headline.
They've got to go back to the draft. They can't do it any other way. And when he came there, and every coach has got to have good players. And you go back to even John Kennedy. Whilst I was there, we were on the bottom of the ladder, and we were fortunate to go to or get zoning. And we got a lot of good young players out of our zone that just put the icing on the cake, who became the backbone of the side. And hence we won 71.
Of course
and
you did.
And Clarkson, when he came, they happened to recruit Hodge, Roughhead, Franklin, Mitchell, Lewis, and it went on. And they became they were the icing on the cake, and then they became the backbone of the side. Now you've got to be very, very lucky at the draft. And
Hawthorn, or know what you're doing.
Beg your pardon?
Or know what you're doing.
Oh, I think there's a lot of luck. I think coaches are so dependent. The most important person is the recruiting manager in a club, because a coach is so dependent on getting the right talent.
Finally, I see the ambulance chaser, Peter Jess, is into it again. How much of an opportunist can that man be? I see Sean Smith got over a million dollar payout for the CTE... that he said he got from playing football. And Peter just said the AFL is treating it like big tobacco. I remember tobacco people used to say that cancer, you couldn't get cancer from smoking. And Peter Jess, does he round up things? Is he an opportunist?
Why? What's in it for him?
Well, notoriety and probably class actions. You know, this is the man that rorted the salary cap while at Carlton.
I forgot to mention Richie Porte too when I was talking about Bridie O'Donnell. Sorry, boys. I mean, to get on the podium in the Sun Tour, Tour de France, he came third. That should be recognised because it's a great effort.
Who is he?
Richie Porte's a Tasmanian. He's a cyclist. Had a bad crash, promised a lot early on in his career, and had a really bad crash, I think, a couple of years ago in the Tour. But he's came third this year, and what a tremendous effort.
And I think you've been unfair on Peter Jess there, Sam.
Why?
Well, it's clearly an issue. I mean, how many more times, from Polly through till, which was, a year ago?
Yep.
Until today?
Yep.
Geez, there's been a hell of a lot of evidence, hasn't there? With Spud and with, you know, Sean Smith Spud, and the other guys.
Sean Smith, Polly, a few others.
Well, you know, Diesel talked about it here.
Yep, a few others.
Well.
As opposed to the 10,000 people who have played in the past.
Well, we don't know how many of them.
What are you?
No, sorry, I can't say yet. You know what I mean.
What's that? I'm trying to just...
My son said that I should donate my brain too.
Yes, we said that, Don.
You know, he said it last week after the Sean Smith. I was driving the car with him.
Yeah,
he said, you suffer. I said, what?
Yeah. Oh, did he really?
Yeah, he said you should donate. What are you on about? Oh, you're short-tempered.
Yeah,
you
that's
keep
true.
Repeating things. You're losing your memory.
That's right. If we could get a snuff box, we could put your brain in that and send it to a clinic. You know what a snuff box is?
I do.
Snuff, do you know what a snuff?
Yeah, snuff, I know what snuff is. The French and English used to do it.
In the mines.
In the middle, not middle they age, the aristocracy.
They put it up their hooter to sneeze.
No, they didn't disguise the smells that were around. They were very unhygienic.
Snuff
people.
Is something you put up your nostrils.
Exactly,
so you
it covers the bad smells that were around in those days because they didn't have sewerage or garbage and whatever else, and they had horrendous smells in around where they lived.
This is
the aristocracy used to put snuff.
That's right. Friend of mine went to the doctor and said, every time I sneeze, I get an erection. And the bloke said, what are you taking for it? He said, pepper.
I'm hoping around the streets late at night. I'm worried because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. I'm just crazy about you, babe.